everyone who loves books. This is Read on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to Read On, your weekly compendium of the best in books and reading. I'm your host, Red Sale, and coming up in today's Halloween special, Kate Helm brings us the tale of a courtroom artist who's haunted by visions.
In her past, there are very dark goings on, and as a result of that, she tends to believe most people are guilty of what they're accused of.
N.B. Dixon reviews a spooky thriller that's about to hit the big screen.
I couldn't stop reading it, even when it got very, very spooky, and I made the mistake of reading it at night. I still couldn't stop.
Daisy Johnson reveals her personal affinity with Halloween.
I was born on Halloween, so I think from a young age, my parents sort of leapt on this as a good party theme. So I've always watched scary films and read scary books.
And David Mitchell takes us to a creepy supernatural mansion and reveals how his characters write to him.
It doesn't really feel like you're engaged in an act of creative art. It's just a letter.
That's all coming up in today's Read On. Kate Helm's new novel, The Secrets You Hide, poses a dilemma familiar to many of us who have a degenerative eye condition. Can we really trust the evidence of our own eyes? A crime thriller with a twist, it was tricky not to give too much away when we spoke on the eve of its publication.
The book is about a courtroom sketch artist, Georgia Sage, and so her job is to sit in trials and to try to capture the essence of the people in the dock, those who are accused, and other witnesses and so on as well. But she has got a hidden agenda, so in her past there are very dark goings on, and as a result of that, she tends to believe most people are guilty of what they're accused of. And so she tries to use her skill to capture the essence, but also to influence how people feel about court cases, until she begins to sense that the very first court case that she sketched may not have been as straightforward, and that she may even have unwittingly participated in a miscarriage of justice. And after that, all goes wrong as she tries to find out what really happened.
It's a fascinating concept. I think, you know, many of us will have seen those wonderful pastel drawings on the news. And thinking of the ones that stick in my mind, the angular-looking defendant seems a lot more guilty all of a sudden, or the rather demure mother sort of talking about terrible things that have happened. I suppose those pictures do influence the way we feel about those people in the trial that's being reported.
You can't help not look at those, and that really is the idea behind them, is to capture some of the drama that goes on inside a courtroom, because of course we're not allowed to have photography or television cameras. It happens occasionally in the States, but even there they use sketch artists. The influence that a sketch artist might have is actually quite limited on the verdict, because jurors, if anyone has been on a jury themselves, they are told to stay away from news coverage. But my character in this is got a darker agenda, I guess. People don't realise a whole load of things. I didn't really when I started off researching this. For example, in the English court, certainly, you're not allowed to do even the slightest sketch while you're in court itself. So a courtroom artist has to instead rely on pen portraits, word portraits, making observations about how people look, how they behave, their demeanour. And it's an incredibly difficult thing to do. I had to really get into that mindset. I haven't got an artistic bone in my body, I have to say, but I can really appreciate the job that these people do in capturing those moments. So unless you've been in court as a juror, or because you're involved in some other way, you've got no sense of what it's really like. And actually, I used to be a courtroom reporter, so I did understand that side of it, but definitely not the sketching.
Well, it amazes me to hear that you don't have any artistic training yourself, because your use of language around colour and paints and the creation of a picture, I'd just assume that you'd actually studied art at art school.
That's very flattering to hear, but I suppose it's one of those things that you actually research in more depth when you know there are the areas that you don't wholly understand. I failed my O-level art, and my art teacher was very sceptical about my abilities. Having said that, I love art. I mean, I love looking at pictures, things like Portrait Artist of the Year or sculpture. And I also am really excited by colour. I always had been. I think when I was doing my O-level, I was going through one of those slightly gothic black and white phases. And since then, I just, the words that conjure up the colours are just so evocative. And it was lovely to have that to play with, actually, as a kind of a word palette when I was working on the book. So perhaps you're getting some of the enthusiasm that I got from that.
Well, now that you've shared the secret that you failed your O-level art, as the title of the book would imply, there are a lot of hidden secrets and half-told stories in The Secrets You Hide, including one of the characters learning very slowly that she has sight loss. Without giving too much away, for people who haven't read the book already, it's a very major theme, and you handle it very deftly, I thought. How did you do your research into the eye condition that the character finds out that she suffers from?
It began actually with a podcast. So I love podcasts when I'm out and about, or if I'm, especially when I'm on the cross trainer at the gym, it's the only way I can motivate myself to keep going. And I heard one where somebody described what it was like to suffer from this particular condition. And I already had the courtroom sketch theme in my mind, and it just seemed, again, without giving too much away, there's a lot around perception and the ways that we fill in the environment around us, whether we have a sight loss issue or not, or any kind of sensory impairment. I don't actually have that in my family. I am, having said that, very, very short-sighted and was from a very, very early age, but it wasn't picked up for a long time. So for most of my childhood, when I couldn't see things the way that other people could, read the blackboard, I had no idea that I actually had a sight loss. And equally, I have some hearing loss, which was only picked up in my early 30s. And that was through something odd, like people would hear the phone in another room and I wouldn't be able to hear it. And yet I had no idea that anything was wrong. And I think that's the really interesting thing about any form of sensory impairment or issue in that area. You start to pick up on things in a different way, and you don't even see it as a deficit. You're just experiencing it as a different way of being in the world. Having said that, once I heard this podcast, I have a journalistic background, and I'm very conscious that if I'm going to try and write about something I haven't got direct experience of, I want to be entirely sure that I'm getting it right and I'm not misrepresenting anything. So I did do a lot of research. I spoke to people at Moorfields and the University College Institute of Ophthalmology. I read a lot of papers, a lot of YouTube interviews with people with this condition, which is so fascinating, but again, we can't really go into it. And also one of the artistic representations was actually Adam Hahn's portraits of people with macular degeneration. So these are pictures where he has sought to speak to people with macular degeneration and understand what it is they see and what they don't see as a result of the condition. And as he's then created these portraits, you get this sort of self-portrait glimpse of what it must be like for those people that he's spoken to. Obviously, everyone experiences it differently, and I absolutely loved looking at those.
Well, as somebody who has experienced the condition that we're talking about, I can say you absolutely nailed it. That awful feeling of not being able to trust the evidence of your own eyes, how that just influences all the decisions that you make, how it wrong-foots you.
I think that we've all experienced that when our perception of anything changes, even when our perception of another person and what they're like changes, we suddenly question everything that we do. I know I did when I found out that I had this hearing loss and I was given hearing aids, and it was utterly bizarre to me. It was a transformation, but it was also really discombobulating, really disorientating to suddenly have these hearing aids and everything, the entire world seemed different. And I was, it struck me, I was thinking, is this how everyone else has been experiencing the world for all this time? Because I could literally hear everything in the engine. The purring of the cat sounded like a tiger. And when I flushed the loo, it was like Niagara Falls. And it's those kind of things that you suddenly realise that we have no real sense of what everyone else is seeing or hearing or smelling. And I love writing about sensory things within fiction anyway. And I have to say, I am so delighted that you said that about the book, because we still can't 100% know. Because again, we're dealing with things that other people experience. So that's a real thrill for me to hear you say that.
You have published books in the past in non-fiction. I actually have one of your excellent books on the 5-2 diet and yummy recipes that you can eat without stuffing yourself full of carbs. But did you move from that non-fiction side to writing fiction after you got your hearing aids?
I have actually always written stories. So I was a journalist at the BBC, simply because it didn't seem to me that you could ever actually write books. It wasn't within my frame of reference. None of our family even went to university, so it didn't seem like something I could do. And all of my writing that I've done in terms of books, so the non-fiction about intermittent fasting, this book, and in fact I've written women's fiction under my own name, which is Kate Harrison, previously as well, it's all to do with what fascinates me at the time. So in the case of the intermittent fasting, I had, as a result of being a full-time self-employed writer, I had put on about 2 stone in weight, 31 pounds, sort of 15, 16 kilos, and I was looking for a way to get shot of it. I tried it, and then I thought, oh, perhaps I could write about it. And in the case of this story, it was actually tying up hearing this another podcast, actually, about a sketch artist in America and thinking, wow, what would that be like, in combination with the experience I had as a 19-year-old cub reporter being in a courtroom. And it was utterly perplexing and fascinating to me. In fact, I think the law, fascination with the law, probably goes back to watching Rumpole of the Bailey and Crown Court, if some of your listeners are old enough like me to remember that. It was just about what's fascinating to me at the time, and I'm really lucky that I'm able to do that. I mean, there is no other job I would rather do.
It's fantastic that your books are being made simultaneously into audiobooks. And actually, I came across The Secrets You Hide because the narrator, Emma Powell, was talking about it in the kitchen as she was making a cup of coffee at the Talking Book Studios here in Camden. Are you a keen listener to audiobooks?
I adore audiobooks, I have to say. I tried them a few years ago, and I don't know if it's that the quality has improved. I definitely think it has, but I couldn't quite focus. And now it is a pleasure. I mean, anything I am doing, whether it is doing the housework or going for a jog, I've always got an audiobook on the go, perhaps 2 or 3 at once. I just think it's such an amazing way of experiencing fiction, quite different, and the narrator can make a tremendous difference to the experience as well. I don't think all books or all narrators are suitable, but yeah, it's wonderful. Why not be doing something else and also being in another world at the same time?
Have you heard the audiobook version of The Secrets You Hide yet?
Do you know what? I haven't. It's I cannot wait.
It's very good.
That's great to hear. No, I think because it's coming out tomorrow as we record this, so I'm really, really excited to hear those words being spoken by somebody who reads for a living.
Kate Helm, thank you so much for appearing as a guest on RNIB Connect Radio.
Thank you. It's been a real pleasure.
The Secrets You Hide by Kate Helm is out now in paperback, audio and ebook formats wherever you buy your books. And Kate will be back to share the books of her life at the end of the show. You're listening to Read On, RNIB Connect Radio's one-stop shop for book news, reviews and author interviews. Still to come in this week's show, Daisy Johnson reveals the story behind her Riverside chiller, Everything Under. And David Mitchell discusses Cloud Atlas and his latest novel, Slade House. But before that, as regular listeners to RNIB Connect Radio will know, our ethos is in our name. It's about connecting our community and ensuring that the voices of blind and visually impaired people are heard. We love to receive your emails and feedback and, here at Read On, your book reviews. You can contact us via the usual address, readonair@rnib.org.uk. Novelist N.B. Dixon is the author of the Outlaw's Legacy series, an alternative history of Robin Hood. It's a rollercoaster ride packed full of family feuds, betrayals, romance, and one man's fight for his beliefs. She's also a voracious reader and a regular contributor to the show. Her latest book review is of a novel that's about to hit the big screen.
Hello, this is N.B. Dixon with my review of The Little Stranger by Sarah Waters. I've heard of this author, but I must admit this is the first book of hers I checked out, and I was intrigued when I heard a trailer for the upcoming film that's based on the book. That was what drew me to it.
The first time I saw Hundreds Hall was July 1919. Nothing could have prepared me for the spell it cast. When I saw the house again 30 years later, I could hardly comprehend the change in the place.
Why don't you tell me what's going on?
You wouldn't believe me.
Mother, this is Dr. Faraday.
How did you find the patient?
A little under the weather. It's war shock.
They brought Caroline home to nurse him.
I'd heard they were troubled.
Very hush-hush about it.
A long time ago. Who's the child here?
What are you doing here?
Susan died before I was born.
There's something evil in this house.
That's nonsense.
Betty, what are you doing here?
You rang for me, miss.
I did not.
Well, Mrs. Ayres was upstairs.
Rang itself.
Did it?
What is all the noise?
I thought it was really gripping. I know I often say that in my reviews, but it's just as true with this book. The reader really does draw you in, sort of from the start, and it's very atmospheric. You instantly get transported back to the past and to a creepy house where a family are living and where you know there's something not quite right. So you've got the mystery element, you've got the slight creepy feeling that intensifies as the book goes on. The Little Stranger is about a local parish doctor who is sent out to an old country house to tend to a serving maid, and he becomes acquainted with the family, and as he gets to know them, there seems to be a darkness that's surrounding them, and it gradually seems to be sucking them into it one by one. And he tries very hard to ignore what's going on, but meanwhile, the crisis or curse is escalating.
I first saw Hundreds Hall when I was 10 years old. It was the summer after the war, and the Ayreses still had most of their money then, were still big people in the district. The event was an Empire Day fete. I stood with a line of other village children making a Boy Scout salute, while Mrs. Ayres and the Colonel went past us, handing out commemorative medals. Afterwards we sat to tea with our parents at long tables on what I suppose was the South Lawn. Mrs. Ayres would have been 24 or 25, her husband a few years older. Their little girl Susan would have been about 6. They must have made a very handsome family, but my memory of them is vague. I recall most vividly the house itself, which struck me as an absolute mansion.
It's a great book. It deals with psychology. It deals with the strength of your beliefs, what one person is prepared to accept. It deals with the unexplained. And I think it's really cleverly handled. I couldn't stop reading it, even when it got very, very spooky. And I made the mistake of reading it at night. I still couldn't stop. So it's billed as horror, and I have to say I don't generally read horror fiction. I wouldn't go so far as to give it that name, but I remember reading another review where somebody described it as chilling, and I think that does apply. But so it's probably not for everybody, but I absolutely loved it. It's narrated by Simon Vance. I'm not usually a fan of his, but I have to say I thought he handled this particular book brilliantly. It is available in the RNIB library, so whether you're planning to go and see the film or not, I would say download the book and read it. It's fantastic. And it has stayed with me, so that's always a sign of a good read.
So when I did see the house again, almost 30 years on from that first visit and shortly after the end of another war, the changes in it appalled me. It was the purest chance that took me out there, for the Ayreses were registered with my partner, David Graham, but he was busy with an emergency case that day, so when the family sent for a doctor, the request was passed on to me. My heart began to sink almost the moment I let myself into the park. I remembered a long approach to the house, through neat rhododendron and laurel. But the park was now so overgrown and untended, my small car had to fight its way down the drive. When I broke free of the bushes at last and found myself on a sweep of lumpy gravel, with the hall directly ahead of me, I put on the brake and gaped in dismay. The house was smaller than in memory, of course, not quite the mansion I'd been recalling, but I'd been expecting that. What horrified me were the signs of decay. Sections of the lovely weathered edgings seemed to have fallen completely away, so that the house's uncertain Georgian outline was even more tentative than before. Ivy had spread, then patchily died, and hung like tangled rat's tail hair. The steps leading up to the broad front door were cracked, with weeds growing lushly up through the seams.
Thanks, as ever, to N.B. Dixon. The Little Stranger by Sarah Waters is available in Braille, giant print, and as TB 16895. You're listening to Read on RNIB Connect Radio. Coming up later, David Mitchell leads us up the garden path to a very creepy mansion. But before that, Daisy Johnson's debut novel has caused quite a splash this year. Everything Under is a dark and haunting novel set on the Oxfordshire waterways. And, as we'll hear, she loves a good spine chiller and has a special reason for celebrating Halloween. Everything Under has a real feeling of a modern fairy tale. Gretel's name harks back to the great fairy tales.
Yeah, fairy tales, myths, all these kind of stories where weird things happen, wolves eat grandmothers, humans turn into trees. And I think this, you know, I've been talking about retelling, I think people are also retelling fairy tales, and I think that's something really, really exciting. Helen O'Yamey does that particularly well. And I did want to have this sense, yeah, this kind of strange fairy tale sense that even though this is our world, anything could happen.
Do you think it makes it easier to offer a critique of what's going on at the present time, then, to come at it from an oblique angle in a fairy tale?
Yeah, definitely. I think that's one of the things retellings does really, really well. You know, one of the books I loved this year was The Silence of the Girls by Pat Barker, and she uses an ancient story to show us, you know, what it's like to be a woman now. And I think coming from an angle is something that writing does really well.
And I hear that you're a huge Stephen King fan as well.
I am, yes. I grew up on Stephen King, so yeah, he's probably why I write such weird books.
Do you enjoy being scared and scaring other people, then?
I do. I was born on Halloween, so I think from a young age, my parents sort of leapt on this as a good party theme. So I've always watched scary films and read scary books, and I think horror can teach you as a writer so many things, you know, how to do tension, how to do suspense, how to really hold the reader at that point between fear and not fear. Yeah, I love horror.
Is there a kind of rule book of horror that you would recommend to any budding writers out there?
Stephen King's book on writing, which is not specifically about horror, but is just about writing, is really good, you know, on writing and how to get into it, how to start, how to edit. I would really recommend that.
And do you have a favourite spine-chilling book, maybe by Stephen King, that you'd recommend for Halloween?
The Shining is always going to be my favourite Stephen King novel. I love everything he writes, but it was the first one I ever read. And I think in that way that the books you read when you're teenagers stay with you, it's really, really stayed with me.
And did you think that the film lived up to the book?
I think the film is good in its own right, but it's not the same as the book. And I can understand why Stephen King was a bit annoyed about it.
Gretel, your protagonist, is a lexicographer. She's looking for the meaning and history in words. And she displays that very much also in her relationship with her mother. There's a need to understand what's happened to her, why she's been put in care, the family history. And yet there's also a horror at turning over the stone and seeing what lies underneath.
Yes, I think she's a really interesting character. I really enjoyed writing her. And when I, she wasn't a lexicographer to begin with. And then when I decided that was what she was going to do, it really made sense, because it's a book about how the language we speak makes us the people we are. And when she was younger, they created a language, and that's made her into this person who, you know, is always wants to know but can't quite stand to, you know, she's a loner, she's isolated.
And it's also a study in inversion, that Gretel is now the carer for her mother, who is in the early stages of dementia, which is the inversion of the mother who should have been looking after the daughter.
Yeah, and I think she feels that really strongly, that, you know, a couple of times throughout the book she says, this is not what's supposed to happen. Parents aren't supposed to leave their children. Parents are supposed to look after, they're supposed to look after their children. It's not supposed to be the other way around. And I think she's happy to look after her mother, but she does feel betrayed, you know, illogically. She feels betrayed also by her mother becoming sick. And it's not a relationship that luckily I've personally experienced. So it's something that I had to research a lot. There's a really good book by Iris Murdoch's husband about what it was like when she got dementia. And it's such a complicated relationship, I think, because this person, you know, who you love is someone different.
And yet I suppose under everything, that degeneration, that loss of parents to the child is what is going to happen to all of us. It's somewhat like original sin. It's there in the background. It's just sometimes we don't turn over the stone to see what's there because it's too frightening.
Yeah, that's right. There's something mythic about it, I suppose, in that way that, everything is circular. And I think that by the end of the book, Gretel has realised that and has, to some extent, come to peace with that.
It makes a fantastic audiobook. Were you involved at all in the recording of it and the choosing of the narrator?
I wasn't. I'm really excited to listen to it, actually. A couple of friends have listened to it and said it's really, really great.
Did you read the book out aloud to yourself?
Initially in my head, but then especially in later drafts, I think it's really important to read out loud. This book in particular is a lot about, you know, the sounds of words and the sound of the landscape, the sound of the water. So it was really important to get the right rhythm in the sentences and to get the sort of flow of it.
You say flow. It's a book that is centred around water. They lived on a canal boat. The Bonarch, the creature that travels by water, that's underneath the surface, is very much central to the plot. And also your first collection of stories, Fen, was very much water-based. What is it about water that fascinates you?
It's hard to say. It's such an unconscious thing. But so I grew up around the Fens, which is this sort of strange landscape which was drained to become farmland. So I think in the Fens there's always this feeling of water once having been there. And perhaps it was that, you know, has put this interest of water into me. The water in everything under is different. It's, you know, it's river water, it's canal water, it's murky, there's things hidden in there. And I think that's what I really loved about writing about water for this book, is that just that idea that there could be anything underneath the surface, and that, you know, the human world is kind of, it can't control the water. The water has a life of its own.
So is there a water theme to whatever you're working on next?
Interestingly, so it's by the sea, but the water isn't quite as important. There's still bits of it. It still threads throughout, but it's not as present as it is in Everything Under and Fen.
Well, I hope that being shortlisted for the Man Booker means that a lot more people are going to dip into Everything Under. Daisy Johnson, thank you so much for being a guest on R&IB Connect Radio. Like all the books on the Man Booker shortlist in this and previous years, Everything Under is available in a full range of accessible formats from the RNIB Library. Just go to rniblibrary.com or call the helpline on 0303 123 9999. That's 0303 123 9999.
The RNIB Helpline is your direct line to the support and advice you need. Whatever your inquiry, the RNIB Helpline team are only a call away with practical and emotional support so you can face the future with confidence. Our friendly, specially trained operators are just a phone call away from 8:45 a.m. and to 5:30 p.m. every weekday. We can help with information on everything you need to know about the RNIB, from eye health, advice on how to volunteer, reading services and loads more, or we can simply offer a listening ear. The RNIB Helpline, here for you on 0303 123 9999. That's 0303 123 9999.
RNIB Talking Books provides more than 1 million audiobooks every year to people with sight loss and is now completely free for all blind and partially sighted people in the UK. The RNIB Library is the largest of its kind in Europe and offers a wide range of fiction and non-fiction titles, which readers can access on CD, on USB, or as a digital download. The RNIB Library also caters for adults and children in both Braille and giant print, so that you can listen how you choose, whether at home or on the go. To find out more about the RNIB Library or to sign up for your free membership, call the RNIB helpline on 0303 123 9999 or visit www.rnib.org.uk/library.
Ever since I borrowed a copy of Anthony Valentine reading Bram Stoker's Dracula from my local library when I was 10, I've had a taste for spooky stories. And my next guest has a talent for sending shivers up my spine. David Mitchell has created a dark occult world whose themes and characters connect across his 7 novels to date, including Cloud Atlas. His latest book, Slade House, features a supernatural mansion in which people disappear. It's a quintet of ghost stories set about the very creepy Slade House, which only appears once every 9 years. Could you tell us a little bit more?
That's a pretty good summary, really. There's an alleyway in a town which is not named, so it might be near you. There's an alley, Slade Alley, and you go down, and ordinarily there's no doors in this alley. You just go in one street, and it turns left, you go along a straight point in the middle, then you turn right, and then you're out on the parallel road. But, as you say, once every 9 years, if things are aligned right, then you'll find a small black iron door down there. And if you're the person for whom it is supposed to open, it will open, and you go inside. And there's a surprisingly large grounds and a house that shouldn't really fit there, given what you may know of the local geography. But nonetheless, the house is there. Usually you've been invited. Usually you've heard about it or you've had an invitation and you've had directions. And you go in, and exactly what happens to you when you're in is what the book is about. But it probably isn't what you were bargaining for.
And what I love...
Happy Halloween.
What I love is that each story begins in fairly much the same way. And just as the reader feels that they know what's going to happen, you turn the screw a little bit.
Thank you very much. And I enjoyed your smuggled in reference to Henry James's A Turn of the Screw there. Nice one. It's something many writers do, so I'm not claiming this is my unique invention, but you can use the reader's expectations as a weapon, if you like, to surprise them, to encourage them to lower their guard. And then once you've done that, you can get inside their head and turn the tables on them. I love it when authors do that to me, so I was trying to do the same with this one. It is It's a quintet of ghost stories, it's true. I almost think of it as five variations on the same ghost story, but ghost story is a genre, and every genre is made of sub-genres, and the ghost story is no exception. There are psychological ghost stories where you're not quite sure if the ghost is happening in the protagonist's head or not. There are historical ghost stories, more in the vein of M.R. James or someone like that. There are borderline horror ghost stories where things take a dark turn in a Stephen King kind of direction. There are what you might call ontological ghost stories, if it's okay to use a word like that at this time of day, where you simply don't know what is real, who the ghost is. Is the ghost who you think it is? Is this poor, innocent puppet as innocent as we think? So with each of the five in Slade House, I tried to write them in a different subgenre of the ghost story. And stories and story by story, they build a bigger kind of a cubist portrait of the house and of the world that the house is in and exactly what is going on. Does that make sense?
It does. And for readers who are very familiar with your work, it's the same world as the Bone Clocks, the novel that came before it, where there are two rival feuding factions of immortal occultists fighting it out in the human world, using humans themselves.
Yeah, that's right. I do like to have my cake and eat it, if you like. I like to spend my writing life making as gigantic a cathedral-sized world as I possibly can. Yet also, I don't want to spend my career on a single Middle Earth or Westeros. So I also like my books to be individuals that make sense if you've read nothing else I've ever written before. So Slade House follows that pattern. I hope it works as a standalone, which is completely coherent if you read nothing else I've ever written. But if you have read other books of mine, then you'll notice a few characters, a few friends and foes creeping in from previous books.
It rewards close reading when you find the name Penhaligon popping up again and you think, oh, I remember that from a previous book. Another feature of your writing is that you seem drawn back and back to where the limits of mortality actually exist for your characters. Is that something that you feel informs your writing or drives your writing?
It's just being middle-aged, mate. You kind of start to see the face in the mirror and say, oh, you're not so young anymore. And you start to kind of feel the creaks in your bones and you look at kids running around and hear them playing in the playground by my house. And yet you really are a different... I mean, you are human, but the similarity ends there. I do like to... I don't know, I think you'd have to... It would be bizarre not to think about mortality, to not consider one's death. I do, and my books are one place that I can, I guess, conduct thought experiments and have different characters with different relationships with death, including the ones in the Bone Clocks, where there's one group who are reborn 49 days after they die in body of a very sick child who then recovers from the sickness anywhere on earth, either gender, again and again and again. They don't want it, they don't know why it happens, but they can't stop it, it just goes on and on. And then there's another group who are more vampire-like, and their fuel is essentially the souls of their victims, so they're more predatory. I guess through them, I was thinking about mortality via immortality, maybe persuading myself that immortality wouldn't be such a great prospect after all, that it's actually the ends of our lives contain our humanity and give value to the finite number of days we have. Now, of course, we all hope that we have as many days as we can, and or at least healthy days where we're able to do things and have experiences which allow us to enjoy life.
And I think one area where immortality does seem to exist in your writing is the story, the narrative will outlast people's lives. It's certainly a feature in your breakthrough novel, Cloud Atlas, or actually the way in which a story is told might change and come full circle from being an oral tradition to a book and then back to an oral tradition. The world of the story seems to be, well, actually, you call it at one point an orison in Cloud Atlas, the new form of storytelling there, which is something close to religion, I believe.
Oh, there's about three things there. That was a very deep question, sir, if I may say so.
I do apologise.
Very deep indeed. We'll come back to orison in a moment. I loved what you were saying about the idea that a narrative is a kind of a life form. If you think about King Arthur, say, not the character, but the set of stories about King Arthur. Now, they were being told, no doubt, 800-900 years ago. They're there in medieval poetry. They're there in the Gawain poet's masterwork. We don't know who that poet's name was. He just called the Gawain poet. He gets named by a character who even in his day belonged to mythology. Isn't that something? Isn't that cool? And then in the 19th century, all sorts of kind of with the rise of nationalism and the search for a sort of an essence of Britishness, or as we might now say, Englishness, depending on what side of the border you're on. It's a body of stories. It's a body. It's a corpus. Mm. And it's great that that word is something that is infused with life. You know, we call it a body, like a living being. And it's difficult to imagine a future UK or a future Britain or a future England or a future Scotland or Wales, because he's there as well, where the life form that we are calling the Arthurian tales is not told. The stories of King Arthur, they live longer than the human beings who tell those stories. They'll probably outlive the artifacts, the DVDs and the books. They'll still be there at the end of the line of people who identify themselves as British. And, of course, he's all over the world as well, just because, for whatever reason, Hollywood likes him and he's an exportable thing. No doubt, well, I know different cultures have their own versions of these immortal stories. It's quite something, isn't it? Nice thought, sir, to kind of view a story as a life form. I really like that. And orison, when you're coining neologisms, it's cool to take existing words that have heft and legacy and heritage and give them a new usage. The tech world does this. Silicon Valley does this. We have the mouse and we scroll and we click on the tab. They're all old words that get given a new, that can kind of get rebooted. And, well, that's another one, isn't it? That get given a new usage and a new purpose. So when I invent a neologism, I prefer not to sort of create a portmanteau word out of thin air or a brand new word that I quite like to use an old one, like orison, which I think is in the King James Bible. It just means a prayer. And to apply it to this new piece of tech, which is something not a million miles away from a holographic iPad. No doubt new media will, even since I wrote Cloud Atlas, the e-book got invented, although it was conceived in science fiction in the mid to late 20th century. But it actually hit the marketplace and is somewhat in decline already. So there you go. Things are always changing.
The life forms that populate your books, your characters, I read somewhere that actually they write letters to you to express their voices. That's how you flesh them out for writing them. Which is a fascinating way of creating your characters. It's as if they've muscled their way into your consciousness.
Thank you for calling it fascinating, because it makes me feel fascinating as well, but I don't really. It just seems quite an obvious thing to do for me. You know, it's to a large part, we are our voices, at least as far as other people perceive us. We are suckers for making judgments about people on how they speak. Sometimes these judgments can be justified, and an educated language user often sounds educated, but not always, not necessarily. But nonetheless, we always do it. So just when I'm bringing a character to life, when I'm thinking of who they are, especially when I'm stuck, actually, if I've hit a bit of a rut and or a reef, and I find myself doing cosmetic corrections on the same scene over and over and over without moving on to any new stuff, it's usually because I don't know the characters well enough. And the way to kind of float the narrative boat off this struck reef is to just get the character to write a confidential letter to me. It's funny, it's somehow easy writing letters. It doesn't really feel like you're engaged in an act of creative art. It's just a letter. The effortlessness of that process, the ease with which you slip into that voice, outwits the block, outwits whatever it is that is getting in the way of the narrative.
I don't know if you've ever listened to the audiobook versions of your books, but actually the characters' voices come through very, very strongly. For those of us who are blind, who have to take most of our information in through what people say to us, they lift themselves out of the audiobook and seem to be speaking directly to the reader, which I guess is why your books are so popular amongst members of the RNIB Talking Books Library.
Well, I'm very happy to hear that. I know the producers of the audiobooks. I've met them and we're in touch occasionally. They seem like a very professional outfit. Actors are remarkable people. They do what I've been saying, what I've been talking about textually, just with their voices. And that's an astonishing talent that I am in awe of, because I really don't have it. But I'm really happy that the audiobooks have given pleasure. I count myself blessed to live in an age where this can happen and where my work can have this aural dimension. So long live all of us, and long live audiobooks.
David Mitchell, thank you so much for telling us about the world of Slade House and also the Bone Clocks, and for being a guest on Read On Air.
Oh, it's really my pleasure. Thanks so much for having me.
Thanks to David Mitchell. All his novels are available from the RNIB Library, including Cloud Atlas, which is TB13891, The Bone Clocks, TB21531, and, if you dare, Slade House, which is TB23001. Now it's back to Kate Helm to hear the books of her life. Kate, was there a book that you read as a child or a young woman that made you want to become an author?
I think that there were a whole series of books that I read as a child by Noel Stretfield, so I pulled out Ballet Shoes as a particular one, but in fact she wrote so many books. And they were all about young people in creative worlds, so they tended to be ballet dancing or cinema or theatre. But she also wrote books set in the Second World War, kind of darker books. Ballet Shoes in particular, which is about the little fossil family, was one that I absolutely adored. There was something about the warmth and yet the struggles that they experienced. I always wanted to be an actor when I was a child. That was what I really wanted to do, rather than being a writer. Although, in retrospect, I absolutely hoovered up every book there was in the house. And I think in a funny kind of way, maybe I've ended up becoming a bit of an actor in the way that the kids did in the Stretfield books, through imagining myself in the voice of the characters and then writing it down rather than actually treading the boards.
The Fossil Sisters lived in the Cromwell Road, at that end of it which is farthest away from the Brompton Road, and yet sufficiently near it to be taken to look at the dolls' houses in the Victoria and Albert every wet day, and if not too wet, expected to save the penny and walk. Saving the penny and walking was a great feature of their lives. "Gum," Pauline the eldest would say, "must have been a very taxi person. He couldn't have ever thought about walking, or he'd never have bought a house at the far end of the longest road in London." "I expect," Petrova the second would argue, "he had a motor car all his own, and he never hired anything." Gum was the quick way of saying Great Uncle Matthew. He was a legendary figure to the children, as he'd gone on a voyage and not come back before any of them were old enough to remember him clearly. He had, however, been of the utmost importance in their lives. "He's been," Pauline once said, "like the stork in the fairy tale. He very nearly did bring us in his beak." Storks in the Fossil Children's Nursery were always called gums after that. Gum had been a very important person. He had collected some of the finest fossils in the world. And though, to many people, fossils may not seem to be very interesting things to collect, there are others who find them as absorbing as sensible collections, such as stamps. Collecting fossils, he naturally needed somewhere to put them. And that is how he came to buy the house in the Cromwell Road. It had large rooms and about 6 floors, including the basement. And on every floor, and in almost every room, he kept fossils.
Ballet Shoes by Noel Stretfield is available in Braille, giant print, and as TB15621. It's narrated by Beth Chalmers. And is there a book that on a rainy day you'd like to curl up with the cat and reread?
Definitely would be Ralph's Party by Lisa Jewell. So in the late 90s, early 2000s, when I was a 20-something working away in the city, there were these books that started to be published, not just chick lit, but they were beautiful, warm, funny, perceptively written books about that age group. And Ralph's Party by Lisa Jewell was one of the ones that really stood out. She writes beautifully, and the chick lit label doesn't cover that at all. The observations, the relationships, friendships with people really made me want to write, and I'd love to do it again. She's evolved, funnily enough, like her readers. So we've grown older, and she's now writing books which are not that dissimilar to the books that I'm writing, in a kind of a thriller, modern relationship, but with a twist and uncertainty theme, and I absolutely love them. But it would be great to go back to Ralph's Party.
Jem took the first turning off Battersea Rise, which brought her into Almanac Road, a small sweep of 3-storey Edwardian houses, long and thin, with basements. Unusual for this part of South London, as she walked down the road, peering nosily into uncurtained basement flats, she began to feel strangely like she had been here before. There was something familiar about the proportions, the width of the pavement, the colour of the bricks, and the spacing between the weedy saplings that lined the road. Jem stopped outside number 31, and the feeling of familiarity increased further. She suddenly felt safe, like a child coming home after a tiring day out to a warm house and Saturday afternoon television. Jem glanced down into the basement flat and saw a young man, his back to the window, talking to someone out of view. It was then that she knew she had been here before. Maybe not this exact place, but somewhere very similar. In her dreams, since she was a teenager, a basement flat in a tall house in a terrace, a view through the window at night, the room lit up. A man on a sofa, smoking a cigarette, whose face she couldn't see. Her destiny. Was this him? Jem rang the doorbell.
Ralph's Party by Lisa Jewell is available commercially in print, audio, and as an ebook. And finally, is there a book that you've read recently that you'd like to share with the Read On listeners?
So I am currently addicted to Unnatural Causes by Dr. Richard Shepherd, who is a Home Office forensic pathologist. It's an audiobook and he narrates it himself. And it is not for the faint-hearted, but it's a combination of the cases that he's done over the years and also the pressures that doing a job like that would create on your home life. I find it utterly fascinating. It's obviously very different from the CSI shows, but I was also a journalist, a really young journalist, around the same time I think he was a young pathologist in the late 80s through the 90s, and it really reminds me of those times, hearing about some of those cases, and you realise what a toll it can take, but also how fascinating the human body is, that it can still tell these stories even after death.
I was young and keen, and it had taken many years to qualify. Years of highly specialised training, far beyond routine anatomical and pathological study. I must admit that so much time spent staring at minute cellular differences on microscope slides nearly bored me into giving it up. On many occasions, I had to re-inspire myself by sneaking into the office of my forensic mentor, Dr. Rufus Crompton. He let me read through his files and look at the booklets of photographs from his cases, and sometimes I'd sit there, engrossed, long into the evening. And by the time I left, I could remind myself why I was doing all this. At last, I qualified. I was rapidly installed at Guy's Hospital in the Department of Forensic Medicine, under the wing of the man who was then the UK's best-known pathologist, Dr. Ian West. In those days, the late 1980s, pathologists were expected to join senior police officers as hard-drinking, tough-talking alpha males. Those who carry out necessary work that repulses others often feel entitled to walk with a swagger in their step, and Ian had that swagger. He was a charismatic man, an excellent pathologist and a bull in the witness box, who was not scared to lock horns with counsel. He knew how to drink, charm women, and hold a public bar spellbound with a good story. Although sometimes rather shy, I had almost convinced myself I was socially competent, until I found myself playing the gawky younger brother to Ian. His light shone in pubs across London, and I stood with an admiring audience in his shadow, seldom daring to risk adding a quip of my own. Or perhaps that was just because I couldn't think of a good one. Anyway, not until at least an hour later.
Unnatural Causes, written and narrated by Dr. Richard Shepherd, is available commercially in a full range of formats wherever you buy your books. Kate Helm, thank you so much for sharing your love of reading with the Read On listeners and for being a guest on RNIB Connect Radio.
Thank you. I just love talking about reading under any circumstances. It's been great.
Don't forget, you can share the books of your life by emailing us at the usual address, readonair@rnib.org.uk. Alas, that's all we've got time for this week. My thanks to all my guests and to everyone who's been in touch. Read On will be back at the same time next week. But if you can't wait that long, why not head to our Audio Boom page? All our past shows are there, complete with book news, reviews, and exclusive author interviews. You'll find a link on the front page of our website, rnibconnectradio.org.uk. Or you can find producer Robert on Twitter at @talking_books. Farewell until next week, and remember to read on.